Is it on?
You want to be on?
Show your family.
If you don't like it in then, you can take it off.
It's not, I'm saying we have veto power, it's not mine.
Still good?
No, but we'll see if people meander.
Huh? Should I turn it?
It's on.
It's on. So, Erev Tov. No, it's okay. My name is Chaim Ben Daniel. And I was a student here in Mechon Meir. I think if my calculations are correct, maybe 33 years ago, something like that. And a few weeks ago, I took part in the Kenes, the reunion of Mechon Meir. Were you there in Modin, Park Modin?
Yes.
Which I was very impressed. I think it was very well organized and very powerful, very moving, very emotional, and I really enjoyed being there. And when I got there, I saw you were there. They put all the Bogrim, the graduates, in different groups by their years. And I was debating which group to sit with, because I didn't know if I should sit with the group of my years or the English-speaking group. I said to myself, you know what, I'll sit with the English-speaking group. Maybe I was in the English program when I was in Mechon Meir. And each guy spoke a little bit, you know, his name, what years he was in Mechon Meir. And Rav Frankenthal was there. And he asked us a question which kind of took me aback at first. He asked us, what pieces of advice would you give to guys first starting out in Mechon Meir? Chozei B'tshuva, what would you advise them? And I was taken aback by the question, and I thought about it, and then I gave him a couple of answers. And he said to me, you know what, I would like to invite you to come to Mechon Meir to speak to the guys and tell them what you just told me. Because it could be very, can help, very effective, whatever. So, I didn't think I'm going to be recorded tonight. That's puts me a little bit not at ease so much. But I'll just speak just maybe 5 minutes of my background. I was born in the USA. You can hear my accent. I was born in New Jersey. When I was seven, my family moved to Brooklyn, New York. And that's basically where I grew up from the age of 7 to 17. That's where I got my accent from. I went to college in New York City, Manhattan. I was accepted to a medical program, a combined 6-7 year medical program. My parents were thrilled at the time. And to make a long story short, during the 2 years I was in college, I came there already feeling somewhat Zionistic, more for, let's say, political reasons. And during those 2 years, whatever, I became more religious, and I got to the point where I just became religious. I was already wearing a kippah, and I very much wanted to come to Israel. And at first I wanted to take maybe a year off and come to Israel. That didn't work out, so I just left the program, came to Israel, and I've been here since, basically. That's the story very, very quickly. When I came to Israel, my parents, as we say in New York, they freaked out. Basically, they were very confused and upset and disappointed, especially after quitting this program. My mother, since passed away about 11 years ago, Zichrono Bracha, she told me she saw in one of the Jewish newspapers there was a program where you can go to an American yeshiva in Israel and get college credit. So she said to me, if you go to Israel, do this program, thinking that I'll get it out of my system, so to speak, and then go back to college in the States. I went to that yeshiva, which was across the street at the time. I was there for maybe a week, and I said, this is not for me, because I felt that I was coming to the same kind of environment that I left. I fled. I didn't want to be in this American New York kind of environment. I wanted something more more Israeli. I'm just doing a quick history. I went to kibbutz afterward to learn Hebrew. I felt I wanted to learn Hebrew at that point. Went to a kibbutz ulpan. And a few months later, I came to Mechon Meir. And I was telling my friend Yaakov that just walking around this building, especially the old building, which was for us wasn't the old building, it was the building. It's very emotional. And, you know, I look at the old Beit Midrash and I said, my God, this was Mechon Meir, this little Beit Midrash. And I didn't think it was so small. And I went down to the Chadar Ochel and I said, my God, this was the Chadar Ochel of all Mechon Meir. And anyway, a lot of nostalgia and memories. That's not why I came here tonight. So I was in Mechon Meir for a couple of years, and then I went on to the yeshiva in Beit El. Beit El at the time had a yeshiva for guys from overseas. And for a person who had been in Mechon Meir for a couple of years, there were basically a few options at the time for people who wanted to, so to speak, move on to, let's say, an intermediate level. If Mechon Meir was a beginner's level, there were a few places that were considered the next level. One of them was Beit El. Some of my friends went to a Teret Kohanim in the old city. Some went to Elon Moreh. I went to Beit El, together also with Rav Menachem Nisman, went to Beit El. He actually came maybe a year before me. And basically, I've been there ever since. I stayed in Beit El. I met my wife in Beit El. My wife came to Beit El when she was 10 years old. She was one of the first, she was one of the founding families of Beit El. And she lived there. And I met my wife there. We got married. And this summer, we're having our 30th anniversary. And we have now 6 children. And for the past 22 years, I'm working for a bank Lumi here in Jerusalem. That's just a quick summary. I can tell the same story in much, much more detail, but that's I didn't come tonight to tell you the story how I became religious, whatever, Baal Teshuva. I came to maybe give some advice to Chozer B'Teshuva. And after Frankenthal asked me the questions, I think I summarized it to basically 2 pieces of advice I would give to a person who is a new Chozer B'Teshuva. Okay, so the first piece of advice that I think I would give is as follows. All of us, especially when we were younger, we like to feel that our families are in favor of what we're doing and they're supporting us. And when you become a Chozer B'Teshuva, you don't always have that. In fact, sometimes you have even the opposite. You know, your family, your close family, your parents, your siblings, your friends, they don't know what you're doing, why you did it, and they think you even maybe you're not so stable, you know, you lose that. You lose that that tmicha in Hebrew, that feeling that people are behind you. Especially if you're younger, at the time I was maybe 18, 19, you really feel you've lost something very important. And what I wanted to say is that, as a piece of advice, don't spend too much effort and energy in trying to convince everybody what you did and why you did it, because the people in your close family don't always want to hear your story, and the chances of you convincing them in most cases are very slim. When I think back to when I was in Mechon Meir, I can think of maybe 2, maybe 3 people that were Mechon Meir that succeeded in having their parents become religious and coming to Israel, but those people were not the majority. In fact, Yaakov was with me in Mechon Meir. Most of us did not agree. Most of us did not have that luxury of convincing our parents to come and join us and move to Israel and so on and so forth. Sometimes what we would do is that we had an agreement between us, friends, that when someone's parents would come, another friend would talk to the parents you know, and then say, aren't you proud of Yaakov who came to Israel and this and that, and maybe you want to come to Israel. But most of us, it was just very hard to have these conversations with our close, close family. But what I do want to say is that, you know, my case, you know, thank God, Baruch Hashem, as the years went by, I got married. And my parents, my family, liked my wife very much. And at first, they kind of make fun of me, what I was doing. I mean, just to give you an example, if I can go back a little bit, I have two older brothers. I'm the youngest. My oldest brother became an architect. The middle brother's a lawyer. I was here. I left the medical program, came to Mechon Meir. When I was in Mechon Meir, at one point, somebody offered me a part-time job to open the men's mikveh in the morning, which I agreed to because I needed the money, just to have some pocket money. So I would go every morning, maybe it was like from 5:30 to 7 or something, to operate the mikveh, you know, open it up, and then, you know, take money from people, then clean up, and when they finish, unlock the door. I remember people asking my parents, so how are your children? My parents would say, well, you know, the older one is now an architect, and then the other one is now finishing law school. And Chaim, you know, left the medical program. He's now working in a mikveh in Jerusalem. You know, and this is how they felt. This is how they, you know, Chaim's working in a mikveh now, you know, and what can we say? And even when I got married, I kind of felt them sometimes kind of jabbing at me, my wife, you know. They would talk to my kids when they were little and say, so when you grow up, what do you want to do? Just have a lot of children? Is that what you want to do in life? You know, have children? The point I want to make is that it took quite a few years until I got to the point where I really began to feel that my close family and friends suddenly began to really respect what I did. When they saw my children as they grew up, they saw, you know, Baruch Hashem, you know, stable children, you know, children, you know, with a sense of humor and very stable. They began to suddenly respect, even admire my whole lifestyle, especially, on the other hand, as I guess you all know, you know, families in the States or anywhere in Chutz La'aretz that are not, you know, observant or close to the Torah, you know the stories, what happens sometimes, you know, this one gets divorced and this one intermarries and this and that. And suddenly, compared to the stories there, I appeared in their eyes as being very stable and solid. I don't want to scare the younger people. I mean, you know, tell you how long that might take, but it can take years. It might take 5, 10 years, 15 years, maybe even more. But eventually, you get to that point. So I think my first piece of advice is that rather than always trying to convince your family, your parents, and you know what you're doing and stuff, try to just concentrate on yourself and your future here. Make it a very important point to, when the time comes, to find a good wife, establish a good family, and invest in your children. And eventually, I think that your family will come along to sing, you know, thank God, you know, you've made a good life for yourselves, and they'll come to respect you and even admire you. I'll tell you one quick story. When I was in, I think, my home year, maybe in Beit El, I was still writing to a good friend of mine from high school, and a Jewish boy, wasn't religious. He told me that he was dating a girl who wasn't Jewish, and I, you know, was in my home year, and I wrote him a letter saying that I think before it gets too serious, I really think you should come to Israel on a trip and see Israel, what it's all about and everything. And this friend of mine got so insulted by my letter. He wrote me a nasty letter back saying, you know, when you became religious, you know, I thought you were a fanatic, but I didn't say anything to you because you were a friend of mine and I respected, you know, what you did and I was quiet. I think you have to respect, you know, my decisions in my life. And we were not in touch for maybe 4 years or something, 4 or 5 years. And I lost a friend a good friend from high school. And then maybe 4 or 5 years later, this friend met my brother someplace, and he asked how I'm doing, and you know, he missed me, and somehow we kind of renewed the contact. So I'm saying, you know, I regret that I wrote that letter, because don't, you know, sometimes you become religious, you almost feel like a missionary, you know, you want everybody to know what you're doing and why, and it doesn't always work. On the other hand, there's another story I can tell you. When I came to Israel, I sat down to write a letter to a cousin of mine, my cousin who's a half year younger than I am, female cousin. I just sat down, I wrote her a letter, and I just explained to her, you know, how I felt about things and why I came to Israel, why I became religious. I thought maybe somehow it would, you know, as it's saying in Hebrew, you know, it leaves your heart, but what comes from the heart goes into the next person's heart. I wrote this letter. Of course, in those days, I wrote a letter. I didn't, you know, there was no email in those days. I wrote a physical letter, sent it off to her. She was in college, and my cousin got the letter. And you know what happened to my cousin as a result of the letter? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And then a couple years later, I got married, and this cousin came to my wedding, with my aunt and uncle, came to my wedding. And when they came to my wedding, my cousin said to me, you know, I have a friend from college also, you know, became religious, and I want to go see her and everything. And she was living in Hebron. So I met this girl who had gotten married. And I said to my cousin, you know, you can invite her to the wedding also, have her come to the wedding. I met my cousin's friend, and she said to me, you know, when I was in college, she said to me, you wrote a letter to your cousin. And one day I saw it on her desk, and I read the letter, and I was so moved, and I was so touched by what you wrote. I began to think about it, and I ended up becoming religious. So I mean, on the other hand, you never know. You know, you shoot an arrow, you never know where it's going to land. You know, but again, I'm just saying, don't be too, you know, worried or upset about your close family and friends who think you're, you know, a little crazy. Just concentrate on building a good future for yourself and family. And I think in most cases, you know, your family will come around to really appreciating in your lifestyle. I mean, just my two older daughters are now married, Ruch Hashem. My oldest daughter, she studied acting. And she went to a school only for girls, and now she's very involved in directing and producing, and she's very busy. She helps schools and girls' high schools and public schools with their school plays, and she writes, directs, produces the whole thing. My family's very impressed. I have this daughter who's not only is she religious, but she's creative and she's doing these things. And the next daughter is a teacher in Jerusalem. I have a son who's after the army. My second son is now in the army in a combat unit. In fact, next week he's graduating from a commander's course. And my parents, my family, when they understand, you know, what unit he's in, they say, that's a very serious combat unit. You know, you're... And my family in the States, my oldest brother, who really gave me a hard time when I became religious. His older boy got married to a very nice Muslim girl. A girl from Turkey, who was a student in the States.
Which person?
My oldest brother, my nephew. I met the girl, very, very nice girl, very sweet girl, but not a Jewish girl, a Muslim. And I'm just saying that, I mean, in the past 5-7 years, I felt that my status in the family has changed from somebody that everybody makes fun of, and, you know, suddenly a person who's, you know, serious, people admire, and, you know, although my family are not Orthodox, I mean, they're still at the level where they would have liked to have seen all their children marry Jewish spouses, and suddenly they realize that, you know, maybe it's like, either you have to come, it's very hard to stay, like, in that middle line of not being religious, but still having your kids all marry Jews. Anyway, in short, my first piece of advice is don't get too upset and nervous when you see that your family is not with you at the early stages. In the future, if you just stay with it, I think they'll come around to eventually understanding and appreciating, even admiring your chosen new lifestyle. That's the first piece of advice. Second piece of advice I wanted to say is that when you become religious and you become what's called a chozer b'tshuva, to a certain extent, each and every one of you, or one of us, poses a threat to people. We pose threats to society. And why is that? Because often people who are not religious, when they meet you and you say, yo, you're a Baal Tshuva, Chozer B'Tshuva, they think to themselves, oh no, he's going to now try and get us all to become religious and this and that. And they're afraid of you to a certain extent. And I want to say about myself that after I got married, I had a few different jobs for a while. I took a course to be a Sofer Stam. I was doing that for a while. And then after that, I became very idealistic. And with a friend of mine who also learned the Mechon Meir, we established a Jewish labor group to build houses and try and replace the Arab labor force that was either on strike or anti-fada, whatever. But eventually, I came to the conclusion I wanted a very serious, good, stable job here in Israel. And I applied for a job at Bank Leumi. And at the time, it was very important for me to get this job. And when you apply for a job in an institution like a very serious bank, and there's a whole process where they give you exams and psychological exams and academic exams and interviews with psychologists. They want to, you know, really see who you are and your personality and everything. And so when I took these exams, I met with psychologists on behalf of the bank, and they asked me questions, you know, how about my childhood and, you know, when how I was raised, and if I was raised in a family that was religious, why I came to Israel. I said to them, look, I came from a family that, you know, a very, very traditional Jewish family. And I came to Israel, I became more so. I left it at that. Because I knew at the time, I'm sitting in Tel Aviv with a psychologist, if I were to say I'm a chozer b'tshuva, right away they would interpret that as something that's to be weary of and to be afraid of. Because many people who are not religious see you as, if you're Baal Tshuva, that you're not so stable. And later on in the bank, after I was there for a few years, I was up to get tenure, what they call kviut, here in Israel. And once again, the same process, go through a bunch of exams and psychologists, and I said the same line. And I said, I came from a family that was traditional, and I became a more so. I didn't use that word Baal Tshuva, because I knew that it might be interpreted badly, and it might endanger my staying at the bank. I'll give you another example. Once I ended up, I was in the emergency room in the hospital here in Chai. I said, like, I forget why, but I was in the Cheder Miyun, the emergency room. And I saw, lying in the bed next to where I was, a guy, I think he was a student at Or Sameach, or Esh HaTorah, another yeshiva, which I'm sure you probably heard of. And the doctor came to ask him, you know, what happened, why he's in the emergency room. And the guy mentioned to the doctor that he's a chozer b'tshuva in this yeshiva. And the doctor said, ah, you're a chozer b'tshuva. So he writes down, you know, ah, chozer b'tshuva. And how long have you been a chozer b'tshuva? Ah, chozer b'tshuva, okay, understand. And, I mean, are you taking medication? Are you, no medication? And I mean, at night, do you sleep well at night? And no. And then it must have been the time where the shifts changed, and there's like a, so the new shift came. And I'm seeing all this happening, and the new doctor from the new shift comes, yeah. And the other doctor says, okay, this is this guy, he's a chozer b'tshuva. Ah, he's a chozer b'tshuva. Uh-huh. And it's like, you know, when you say you're chozer b'tshuva to people like that, they look at you as if you're something is, you know, I don't know. You,
Tomaz.
Huh?
Tomaz.
Yeah, you know, whatever. You're not so stable. Who knows what he can do? He might end up dancing in the Chedemiyun. He might start, whatever. No one knows what to expect. So what I'm trying to say is that when you get to the point, I mean, I assume, I hope all of you will end up living in Israel. And at some point, you might want to, you know, advance. You know, you end up going to the army, you get a job. You don't always have to say to everybody, you're a Chozer B'tshuva. Always look at the situation where you're at. If you're meeting with a group from Birthright, from Taglit, or you're meeting with a group of people from a kibbutz ulpan, or maybe American students who are here at Hebrew University on the one-year program, then you can say, you can tell them your whole story, that you know, your father, you know, works as a hitman for the Italian mafia, and your mother, you know, used to be a drug addict, and you grew up, you know, you tell them your whole crazy story, and then you end up, you know, you did this, you heard Homir, you're about you. Okay, because to that kind of group, that sounds very interesting, and it might even appeal to some people to maybe come to Mohammedi or whatever. But if you're not in that situation and you're with serious people at a workplace, at a company, you don't always have to say, I'm a Chozer B'tshuva, because they might look at it in a very, you know, weary kind of way. And I wanted to say also that not only for people that are secular, not religious, do you pose a threat, but to a certain extent, even to people that are religious, that were born religious, we also pose a bit of a threat. And why is that? First of all, I think that many people who are born religious, raised religious, don't always have a very deep emunah as to why they're doing what they're doing. Often people who grew up in a family that's religious, just do this lifestyle because that's what they were used to and they're brought up doing. Not everybody is, for example, not everybody who's religious is capable of coming to Mechon Meir and giving a talk to guys who are newly religious or thinking of becoming religious because their emunah is not so solid where they can pass it over to somebody who's still like kind of debating or thinking what to do. And you come to your Chozer B'tshuva, you often put them in a situation where they don't really know how to deal with you. And, I mean, are the guys who are married, or are you all single, or
you married? Divorced.
Divorced. Married, anybody? You know, when you get to the point where you want to meet a girl to get married, if you meet a girl who, like yourselves, let's say, was raised not religious and became religious, okay, so then she knows where you're coming from and you know where she's coming from. But if you meet a girl who was raised religious, often her parents might look at you, oh my God, he's a Chozer B'tshuva. You know, they're like scared of you in a way because they say, oh my God, you know, this guy is dating our daughter, you know, and okay, he became a Chozer B'tshuva, but he might just like go back to where he was, you know, and they're kind of afraid of that. And in some circles, if you're a Chozer B'tshuva, I mean, as far as the trying to get married and meeting people, the reality is that in some circles, if you're Chozer B'tshuva, you're considered second rate. You're considered what they call in Hebrew suk bet. And the problem is even worse in the States. I had a friend here, Shabtai, who was with us in the Chol Meir. He was from New York, and at one point he had to go back to the States. His father was sick in the hospital. He went back to the States, and he got stuck there, as they say, for a few years. And he began to go out with girls, and he was going out with girls who were, of course, religious girls. He told me he was dating a girl. He went out with her maybe 3-4 times, and it was going very well. You know, he liked her, and she liked him. And then suddenly he gets a phone call from the girl, and she says to him, I can't see you anymore. He said, why? What happened? And she said, my father found out that you're a Baal Tshuva, and my father doesn't agree that I should go out, I should date a guy who's a Baal Tshuva. I'm sorry, we have to finish it right here. And he was in shock. And So what I want to say to you is that not only when you're dealing with a psychologist from Bank Leumi, so you have to kind of maybe say, I'm from a traditional family, I just kind of became a little more so. Sometimes when you get to the point where you're dating a girl who grew up in a family that's religious, also you don't have to stress, I'm a Chozer Tshuva, and you can say similarly that I grew up in a family that, you know, very Jewish family, very devoted family, and traditional, and I, you know, came to Islam, became more so. When I met my wife is Israeli. She comes from a Yemenite family. I remember when after we went out for a while and we told the family we want to get married, her grandfather, Zichron Avachai, since passed away, Yemenite man, you know, very religious, with a beard, I think, longer than yours. You know, we said we're getting married. He looked at me with his look. You know, everyone was happy, saying, Mazel Tov, Mazel Tov. And he was looking at me, you know, with his look. You know, he said to me,
who is this guy?
You know, who's this guy? You know, and he said to me, you won't take Michal with you to the States. I said, no, I'm staying here. And he was very skeptical. And and after we got engaged, I remember... remember, when I went back to the States or something, I took back with me a picture that we had in my house of my great-grandfather in Russia with a beard, you know, and big yarmulke, you know, and I brought it back to my wife's grandfather saying, see, here's a picture of my great-grandfather. So you should see. Now, when I say to you, as far as, you know, to tell people that you come from a traditional family, I thought about it. I don't think that I'm lying, because what does the word mean, traditional? I mean, if you grew up in a family where you lit a Hanukkah on Hanukkah, or your parents or your grandparents used to make a Passover Seder, or you or your parents or grandparents used to fast on Yom Kippur, as far as I'm concerned, that's a traditional family. You know? So I'm just saying that it's important to, when you speak to people and you tell people about yourselves, and always think of who you're speaking with. I mean, again, if you're speaking with a group of young people on Birthright, you know, you can tell them the story, you know, but when I was with Bank Leumi, I did not tell them that when I was a little boy in New Jersey, I used to paint Easter eggs and hide Easter eggs and eat pork chops and, you know, and all the, I didn't tell them all these things because they would look at me like, oh my God, he used to Easter eggs and pork chops, and now you. I just said I'm a family that was traditional, and I became more so. So anyway, those are the two things I mentioned to Rav Frankenthal in just maybe a short answer that I kind of elaborated more so. The two pieces of advice are, one, be patient with your family. Don't try to convince everybody, and don't be a missionary so much. Just concentrate on yourselves, building yourselves a good family, a good lifestyle. And I think eventually people will come around to respecting you and even admiring you. That's number one. And two, don't always brag in every situation that you're a Chozer B'Tshuva. Think of who you're sitting with. If you're sitting with a potential employer, if you're sitting with your potential future in-laws, you know, just think of how you present yourself, what you say. And those are my two pieces of advice from a person who was in Mechom Meir 33 years ago and is now the father of six children. By the way, I didn't mention to you, my second daughter is married to the son of Rav Dani Shachotun, who's in here in Mechom Meir. You know Dani, Rav Dani Shachotun? Rav Dani. So Rav Dani is my Michutan. And this cup of coffee was given to me by his wife, Orna. And I have to give it back to her after I finish this speak. And I wish you all, you know, the best of luck. And you should all build, beautiful families here in Israel. And any questions?
Yeah. My question is all the time the same question. How to bring the American Jewish people to Israel with your experience? How you speak with American? I'm from the Swiss mountains, so I even don't know how to speak with American to convince him to come to Israel. What's the language you have to speak with?
I'll tell you something.
because we see things are changing, and we still have very good time to come. You take the money, you take your family, but things will change. The Rosh Yeshiva mentioned yesterday, there will be a time that we have 24 hours. And they will say, in 24 hours you have to leave. Everything behind you ran away. It happened here, it happened there, and it will come back. History is coming back. So I see this picture, 24 hours. When it will happen, we don't know.
You know, I think even some big rabbis, including Rav Kook and some other big rabbis who learned Kabbalah and everything, they taught a very deep concept, which, of course, is above my head, but I maybe understood maybe a little bit of the concept. And Rav Kook writes in one of his books that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided to that the process of redemption of Geula has to now begin and increase its pace and momentum, what did he do? He did something very simple in his eyes. What he did was that as new babies were being, Jewish babies were being born, he put in some of them a soul, a neshama of Eretz Yisrael. And this baby, who was born with this neshama of Eretz Yisrael, it doesn't matter if he grew up in Vancouver, Canada, or in Brooklyn, New York, or in the Swiss mountains, eventually he's going to end up being attracted to come to Eretz Yisrael. Mm-hmm. Now, other people don't necessarily have this neshama, and you can't
communicate.
It's so hard. I once wrote a short story. Maybe I can even, I'll send a copy to Rabbi Frankenthal. I wrote a short story about lions. And if you compare a lion who's living in a cage in a zoo, you compare that lion to a lion in the jungle. If you think about it, each lion feels sorry for the other one.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Because the lion who's living in the cage says, this poor lion, he's living outside, you know, he has to get his own food, he's cold, when it rains he gets wet. Now I'm living here in the cage, they give me food every day. When it rains I'm dry. He's a miskin, that poor lion out there. And the lion in the jungle says, he's living in the cage. He's in a zoo, this poor guy, you know? So I think that kind of explains a little bit the relationship between Jews like ourselves who've decided to live in Israel and Jews still living outside. Like each one of us feels sorry for the other one. You know, the Jews in America say, my God, you know, this guy is making a meager salary, you know, and living in an apartment. He's living, you know, he has two or three or four children in one bedroom. You know, when a Jew comes from the States, comes to Israel, and he goes to a furniture store in Talpiot or Mea Sharim, and he sees a bed, not a bunk bed, he sees a bed that has like one, two, three beds, and then a pullout for four or five. They say, my God, are there families that use these beds? They cannot believe that. Who? What is this? I mean, in the American Navy, they have nicer conditions. How can you sleep in this? You know, in America, people grow up, you know, one person per bedroom, and usually the child in a bedroom in America puts his bed right in the middle of the room. You think about it; it's interesting. In Israel, in most houses, people always put their bed next to the wall. Why?
I don't know. Why not? That's the normal way.
No, because if you have a guest, if you want to invite friends, you know, you want to, for Shabbat, you know, people come, you can, you know, put the other guests, you know, in the rest of the room. You put a mattress on the floor. You know, in America, people aren't used to this kind of thing where, you know, suddenly a family comes and invades your house for Shabbat and you have this, you know, people aren't used to that. And I'm just saying, so to answer your question, how do you explain to people? You're talking to people that they're living in a zoo, in a cage. And it's not easy to explain to them. But we have to try our best. and concentrate on those people who come to Israel. I think. Now, I think, you know, the Sochnut, the Jewish agency, they invest so much effort in bringing Jews to Israel, but once you come here, there's no one to really see what you're doing and following you and helping you. And I think that that's part of the answer, to help people who already come here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's right. That's very much right.
And look, eventually some people come around, some people maybe not. Look, in this parsha, you know, Shlach Lecha, this is the parsha, you know, where 12 spies. By the way, when I was in Machom Yira 33 years ago, I remember somebody pointed out to me, you know, I put a place mark here. You know, it says in this, in the parsha, "Vayedaber Hashem el Moshe le'emor, Shalach lecha anashim v'yatur et ha'aretz." You know, the word "to tour" in English, which comes from, I think, a Latin root, comes from this Hebrew word, "latur." There are some words in English that the root is in Hebrew. Like, for example, that jubilee, I don't know, it comes from the word yovel, or other words. And one of them is tour. The concept of la tour comes from this parsha. And from this parsha, you can learn that to come to Israel as a tourist, in a way, is a very negative thing. Because when you come as a tourist, it's like you're saying, okay, you know, God gave us this land, but I want to check it out, you know, see if it's really for me, you know. And to a certain extent, to come here as a Jew, as a tourist, it's a, in a way, it's a chutzpah, you know. This is what Hashem gave us. What, you want to check it out? You know, you're not sure if it's for you. And but it's not easy. Here we see it in the parsha that a lot of the people who explain this parsha, they explained that these 10 spies who were all like leaders of the Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, they just couldn't relate to Eretz Yisrael. They just couldn't relate to it. And I believe the Ramchal writes in the book, The Path of the Just, in Mislat Yesharim, remember in chapter 11, in Perek Yud Aleph, he explains, he says that these 10 spies, these 10 Meraglim, saw themselves as the leaders of the Jewish people outside of Israel. And they kind of felt deep down, maybe subconsciously, that when they come to Israel, there'll be a different reality here. And maybe they won't be the leaders anymore. Mm-hmm. So deep down, they kind of had a resentment. Mm-hmm. By the way, I always say that, you know, for a person to make Aliyah from America to Israel, if a person worked in America as an engineer, okay, he'll come to Israel, he'll be an engineer, he'll make maybe one-fifth of his salary, but he'll be an engineer. If he was a doctor in Chutz Laaretz, he'll be a doctor here. He'll make a fraction, and he won't have the respect. But if a person is a rabbi in America, or Canada, with a big congregation, he comes to Israel, what can he do? I know a guy, by the way, he was once a client of mine in the bank. He was a rabbi in America with a big congregation. And he decided to move to Israel. He came to Israel and he thought that, okay, he was a rabbi, he'll work in education, he'll be a teacher. And he taught in a school. His Hebrew wasn't so good. The students laughed at him. And after a very short while, he said to himself, this is not for me, I can't be a teacher here in Israel. So what did he do, this particular rabbi? He took a course to be a plumber. And he worked as a plumber. And he said to himself that, I want to stay in Israel. It's important for me. I have to pay my mortgage. I have to support my family. I'll be a plumber. He took a course. He became a plumber. He was a very good plumber. And then he advanced to becoming more of a contractor. And in my opinion, what he did is similar to the two Miraglim, Yeshua ben Nun and Caleb ben Yefuneh, that they said, okay, we'll come to Israel. If need be, we won't be the leaders of our tribes, but we'll come to Israel. But most people who are in that position, it's very hard. It's I remember reading an article in the Jerusalem Post years ago, written by Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, who's the rabbi of Efrat. And he wrote an article after being in Israel maybe 5-7 years or so. And he said, he was very honest, he said, it's very hard for me. He said, when I was in America, I was considered an expert on Israeli affairs, and I was an expert. I remember that one time in America, they made a list of the 10 most influential Jews in America, and he was one of them. And he comes to Israel, and he's not considered one of the 10 most influential Jews. And he is, I think, very special in that. He's one of the very few people that managed to switch from being a rabbi of a congregation in America to being a rabbi of a congregation, of a kehillah, of a settlement here in Israel. But that's very, very rare. And I'm just saying, when we're speaking to people in America, as much as we want people to make aliyah to come here, it's not easy, because it's much more than an intellectual debate or proving to them or what's written or the halakha. It's something much deeper. People just can't relate. Think about it for a couple of thousand years, Jews could not come to Israel. It just wasn't possible. So Jews began to think, okay, one day we'll come to Israel. When Mashiach comes, we'll come to Israel. And Jews developed a whole approach to Torah and to Eretz Yisrael and to Judaism, that when Mashiach comes, we'll come to Israel, because it wasn't possible. And then when it became possible, it wasn't suddenly overnight. It became possible very, very gradually. If you go back a couple hundred years, the Vilna Gaon, the Gaon from Vilna, and also the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov was the founder of the Hasidic movement, and the Gaon from Vilna, he was not in favor of the Hasidic movement. And on some issues, them and their students, they were at opposite ends. But if there's one thing that they had in common, was that both the Gaon from Vilna and both the Baal Shem Tov realized that we're now in a period where it's now time to come back to Israel, and they sent their students to Israel. And when people came to Israel during those years, maybe 90% of the Jews living here were living on charity.
Right.
And maybe 80% ended up dying from malaria or from disease. And who was here? The Turks were here. The Turks were very vicious and tough leaders, and they gave the Jews a very hard time. And as the years went by, suddenly it wasn't 90% of the Jews living on charity, it was only 80%. And it wasn't 70% dying from malaria, it was maybe 55%. And it was very gradual. And most of the Jews, it was very hard for them to realize that redemption
is coming slowly. Yeah.
Is coming very slowly. It says, what does it say in Masechet Ta'anit? That if a person mourns the destruction of Jerusalem properly, he'll merit to see it being rebuilt. And you can ask the question, why does it say merit to seeing it being built? Say he'll merit to living in a time where it's being rebuilt. And it says Dafka, he'll merit to see it being built. Why? Because some people live during the time of redemption, but they don't see it. Not everybody sees it. And we see it. And it's not easy to show it to other people. It's not easy. But what's important for us is just to be here and be happy and be stable. And like I said in the beginning, eventually people will begin to see that there's something to this. That's not easy. It's anyway. Any other questions, comments?
Shafa.
Okay. I wish you all best of luck.
If you have a question, I wanted to mention one thing. You said a very powerful line when we spoke. Yom Kippur is what you said. You said, the Mishnah says, a person should look at Me'ayin Bata Ulan Ata Olech. Where are you coming from and where are you going to? Mm-hmm. The Mishnah says, and you had said, that very often,
that's right.
You think
I remember
about where am I coming from? What was my
that's
father's
right.
being, my grandfather's
That's right. You're
being.
Right. You're right. I remember now when we spoke about that. Maybe that's a third piece of advice, perhaps, that would help me personally get by those initial years when I was in Mechome year, and was that rather than thinking of where I came from and how disappointed people were in what I was doing, I always thought of the future. And I was a single boy in Mechome year. I said to myself, one day I'm going to be a husband and a father of children, and I have responsibility, not just to my grandmother, who was very upset that I left college, but I have responsibility to my children, to make sure that they're brought up here and they live here, and to my grandchildren. Now, you know, thank God I have two grandchildren. And always think kadima, always think of the future. And just like that helped me get by, I think that would also help all of you get by. Always think of the future and your responsibility to your future generations, your future offspring.
We're here every Thursday night, so start preparing for next week.